such as Libya and Iran, but these countries were either thrown into a war or heavily sanctioned in the name of NATO's interests. And for this reason today, we depend very much on Russia's gas.
While the EU is expected to unveil a new energy strategy to reduce its member states' dependency from Moscow's gas, on Friday the Italian Foreign Minister Di Maio warned that if Russia thinks it can blackmail Italy on energy, then they've got the wrong country. According to some geopolitical experts, European countries must keep into account that Russia would be capable of turning off gas supplies to the old continent. Max Civili, Rome.
A huge number of Ukrainian refugees continue to arrive at EU borders in Poland, Slovakia, Romania and Hungary. On Thursday, EU Home Affairs ministers adopted the Temporary Protection Directive. It means the refugees can work and go to school in any of the bloc's 27 member states for at least 1 year.
If you compare to the refugees that came in 2015, how long time it took to have the proper decisions. For example, just to have their asylum applications processed, it could take years.
So, by the EU's own admission, refugees travelling here from conflict zones involving Western military powers did not and do not receive the same protection. Meanwhile, advocates are calling on the EU to pay particular attention to certain groups.
In general, people who are displaced in a forced way are vulnerable. We want to call attention to specifically the situation of women and girls because they are disproportionately affected.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen travelled to Slovakia and Romania on Thursday to assess the refugee crises facing the two EU nations. She took the opportunity to try and apply additional pressure on Moscow.
The three waves of sanctions we introduced are already having an impact on the Russian economy and therefore Putin's war effort. And we will take additional steps if the situation deteriorates on the ground.
Non-EU country Moldova has taken in more than 100,000 Ukrainian refugees so far. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell visited the country on Thursday to offer support. However, there is concern over the treatment of some who are trying to reach the EU from Ukraine. Senior UN officials are criticising evidence of discrimination by EU border authorities against African and Asian nationals attempting to flee the conflict. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Press TV, Brussels.
Al-Fajr cultural days have kicked off, but this time it is not held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Rather, Beirut is hosting the event like many other Iranian art exhibitions held here.
Activities include many art activities, theater, music, exhibition, seminars and other activities.
The Iranian Minister of Culture opened the festivals with an awe-inspiring musical concert. Iranian musicians there glad to be attending such an event.
I'm a musician from Iran. I play oud, a common instrument in Muslim world. I really like the Arabic culture, Arabic countries' cultures. By myself, and I think the collaboration between Muslim countries, it would be good. Something like Fajr days in Lebanon, and I really enjoy my stay in Lebanon.
The many facets of Iran's artistic culture have come all the way to Lebanon, from the folklore dress to post-Islamic calligraphy.
This exhibition is for Iranian exhibition for the Iranian handicraft for before Islam and after Islam.
According to organizers, this event is significant in that it represents part of collaboration between Iran and Lebanon. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The World Bank has recently approved a plan to use more than $1 billion from a frozen Afghan trust fund for aid in Afghanistan through UN agencies and charities. Afghan experts welcoming the move suggest that there should be a clear mechanism for disbursing the money so that Afghanistan gains the greatest benefits.
Allocating $1 billion as aid is a piece of good news for Afghanistan, but there should be a clear and appropriate mechanism so that the money is not wasted like hundreds of billions of dollars that were poured into Afghanistan in the past 20 years. I think, first of all, the UN should come to an understanding with the Taliban. Then they can assess needs or create jobs through developmental and fundamental projects.
This comes as unemployment, poverty and hunger crises are deepening in Afghan society. Afghans expect the Taliban and international community to create job opportunities, calling for unfreeze of Afghanistan's frozen funds and more aid to the country.
We have been experiencing a very harsh winter. Many died of hunger and illnesses. We neither have a job nor received humanitarian aid.
Following the Taliban takeover, the U.S. froze some $9 billion in Afghan central bank assets and large global funds to the country were halted. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Turkey has closed the passage of warships through its Straits of Bosphorus and Dardanelles. The decision was taken after Ankara called Russia's military action in Ukraine a war. President Erdogan said Turkey is using the authority given to it by the 1963 Montreux Convention Pact on passage of its straits to prevent the escalation of the Russia and Ukraine conflict.
Turkey is determined to use the authority given by the Montreux Convention on Turkish Straits in a manner to prevent escalation of the Russia-Ukraine crisis.
Erdogan said he was very saddened by Moscow's attack on its neighbor, describing the move as unacceptable, adding that Turkey will not abandon its ties with both Ukraine and Russia. The Turkish defense minister, in his turn, asked all sides to respect the international pact Turkey has worked by, assuring that it is Ankara's right to limit passage in the straits in wartime. Kiev had already asked Turkey to close its straits to the Russian warships. The move will prevent more Russian ships from reaching the Black Sea, from where it had launched attacks on Ukrainian southern coast. Analysts say Turkey's decision does not only help Ukraine but also Russia, as the decision prevents all warships, not only Russian ones, from crossing the straits.
Turkey is following a balanced policy between the two countries. The president already clearly stated that Ankara will not take side and stand with neither Russia nor Ukraine. However, enforcing the Montreux Convention is an international procedure, which will not affect Russia negatively, and Ukraine had already asked for it, hence Turkey will not be put in a position to choose sides. However, Turkey already rejects the Russian military action.
Turkey maintains good ties with both Russia and Ukraine, as it bought S-400 missiles from the first and sold the drones to the second, and does not seem willing to risk taking sides in this conflict. It seems that Turkey is trying to remain impartial in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, while it's trying to mediate to end the fight, with President Erdogan making some calls and pushing for a political solution. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Home Office has verified that the majority of people trying to reach the UK's shores via the English Channel are fleeing war and persecution. This comes in response to allegations made by the Home Secretary that the majority are illegitimate, in her own words, asylum shoppers.
If the laws that they're trying to put through Parliament at the present time, if they had been in process at the time that the present Home Secretary, Priti Patel, the time her family came as refugees and asylum seekers from Uganda, they would not have been allowed to come into the United Kingdom. Or if they did come into the United Kingdom, they would be put into some sort of detention camps that she is advocating.
The issue of Ukrainian refugees also got off to a rocky start, with the Home Secretary suggesting they could benefit from fruit picker visas. Now, under pressure, the government is offering emergency visas for those with family members already living in Britain. but at the same time the government is pushing through legislation that will criminalise those coming from the Middle East and Africa, specifically via the English Channel, and people protesting this are getting mixed responses.
It's interesting that while we've been reporting here today, we have heard people pass by making some pretty off-colour remarks about refugees arriving here in this country. And that just confirms that there is a lack of sympathy here. And some would say those sentiments stem from misinformation, but most importantly, from racism. White skin, blue eyes. They've said it on the media. White skin, blue eyes means you're acceptable. If you're brown-skinned or black-skinned, you're not acceptable. And it's a form of apartheid.
There are people who have been driven to suicide after arriving in Britain. There were actually more people dying after being in the hands of the Home Office here than the numbers that had been dying crossing the Channel. And that is crazy to think that the hope and the aspiration that drives a person to risk their life, the kind of Britain that they're hoping for, is the one we want to live in. But it's not the one we have. It's what we have is deeply driven, divided by racism.
The Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK extraordinary powers to criminalise, prosecute and imprison refugees, and give the Coast Guard immunity from prosecution if refugees die at sea. There have been widespread protests demanding this bill be scrapped, specifically now that the government is poised to issue hundreds of thousands of visas for Ukrainians, proving that when there's a will, there's a way. Bianca Rahimi, London.
British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's licence to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik, as well as their subsidiaries, will no longer be able to spread their lies to justify Putin's war and to sow division in our union.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship. And the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy, and that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavita Hawaii. The JCPOA revival talks continue in Vienna.
Even though many were of the understanding that the talks should have borne fruit by the end of February, that has not happened. Two major developments, though, have occurred. First, Iran and the IAEA have agreed to a roadmap to resolve all outstanding issues. But there seems to be a monkey wrench thrown into the revival talks. Russia wants written guarantees from the United States that sanctions on Russia will not damage its cooperation with Iran. Just a couple angles we will be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. But first, to get the latest on what is going on, Homa Leslie is a correspondent joining us from Vienna. Well, Homa, tell us about the IAEA chief's visit to Tehran, what was achieved there, and, of course, any new developments that there has been one major one, which I'm going to ask you about.
Yeah, so we know that the negotiations here, the Vienna talks aimed at restoring the JCPOA, are still ongoing. As you said there, there was this expectation that soon we're going to have the foreign ministers come and make an announcement. A part of this, an important part, basically, of the disagreements or sticking points concerned the issue of Iran's safeguards cases under IAEA investigation. Now, with the trip made by Rafael Grossi, that has been basically seen as a positive move. It's been seen with optimism by the negotiators here because the sides have agreed on a roadmap to get these issues resolved. And Mr. Eslami, I think, did make it quite clear in the press conference in Tehran that that is a red line for Iran. It wants these cases permanently closed. And now there's a specific roadmap and timeline to get there. But now, you just mentioned there, this new issue, Mr. Lavrov making those comments has thrown a huge question mark over the whole process of the negotiations. But let's just make some aspects of it clear. Mr. Lavrov, in his comments, and I'm quoting here from the report, says, "We want to be able to have a free and full trade, economic and investment cooperation and military technical cooperation with Iran. We don't want these sanctions to affect that," which is making it quite broad. But at the same time, the Russian ambassador here, Mikhail Olyanov, who's engaged in the talk, the Russian negotiator, tweeted that he tweeted this after Mr. Lavrov's message. He said that he's met with EU coordinator Enrique Mora, and they have, and I'm quoting him here, they have raised a number of questions that need to be addressed now in order to ensure the smooth civil nuclear cooperation with Iran. So he's just put it in the framework of nuclear cooperation. We know, of course, that that nuclear cooperation under the JCPOA includes, for instance, the returning the Fordo plant into a research center with the help of Russia, the supply of fuel to the Tehran research reactor, the exchange of enriched uranium for yellow cake, etc. That's what we're talking about. And also, I'll just quickly mention here, Carver, if I can, one Western diplomat has already been quoted saying that if Russian demands for these guarantees just and purely pertain to the nuclear cooperation with Iran, as Mr. Olyanov is saying, then that, quote, can be managed. But this diplomat says if Lavrov is using this as a play to try and carve a huge hole out of the overall Ukraine sanctions, then that's a different story.
Okay, any reactions from Iran on this?
At the moment, we had one news story saying that an Iranian member of the team has said that this Lavrov position is not constructive, but this was strongly rejected by the Iranian team, and sources close to the team and members of the team said that this is a fabricated quote, and up until this stage, they have not made any comments about this issue. But I just like to quickly point out that as far as we know, they have said that these negotiations are continuing. And yes, I'm just trying to find the quote. What this source said was at the same time that Iran believes neither war nor sanctions are the solution to any crisis. At the same time, the expectation is that the talks and cooperation, as per the JCPOA, will not be influenced by international developments and sanctions regimes.
Thank you so much for that. I'm glad I asked you that then, because you clarified this point for us, especially on the Iranian side, that that was rejected. Homa Leslie there from Vienna, many thanks. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us, veteran journalist and writer Elijah Magnier, who joins us from Brussels. Also joining us is journalist and political analyst Hafsa Kara Mustafa, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Hafsa Kaher Mostafa, let me first start with you. So February's come and gone, and no JCPOA revival has occurred, unlike what people thought. Now, we had the visit by the IAEA chief today to the Iranian capital, Tehran. But what we're looking at is a landscape which there are just too many ambiguities and doubts from the people who are from the outside looking in. And I'm asking you what your thoughts are so far in terms of where this stands. What are your thoughts?
Well, obviously, this has been a very, very long week. And what could have been a sort of a different scenario just a couple of weeks ago is now made very different because of the war between Ukraine and Russia and obviously the heavy sanctions regime imposed now on Russia. I think this is a very good development because it obviously gives Iran the upper hand. Remember, this is a time where energy prices are soaring and many European countries, namely Germany, which is the biggest economy in the EU, is highly reliant on Russian gas and can no longer access it because of the sanction regime. So now the Iranian gas and the Iranian market, in essence, is extraordinarily appealing to the EU, who must have regretted following so blindly the Americans in sanctioning Iran, and are obviously trying to get closer. So I think this is an incredibly positive development for Iran, because not only does it open up a new market, not only can this now put these heinous sanctions behind, obviously not all, because concessions will have to be made, but I think progress will have to be made. And obviously, Iran now is in a far better position. So I think all in all, this is a very good week.
Okay, well, let's see what Elijah Magnier thinks. Elijah Magnier, we're looking at obviously the impact that I'm not going to get too much into the IAEA-Iran deal, though maybe I may later, but the military execution of Russia on Ukraine has had impacts. And in this case, as our guests there said, perhaps it's going to have a positive return for Iran were this JCPOA revival to happen. Do you view it that way?
Yes and no, because President Putin said today that if we don't sell our oil, nobody's going to sell it. So it means that this is very clear that nobody is going to benefit from oil if Russia is under sanction in not selling oil and gas to those who are buying it already. However, on the other hand, if the deal is concluded, it has a positive influence on the market, because so far nobody said that Putin cannot sell its oil. And since the United States is the first, depending on the month, or the second largest importer of oil from the from Russia, and Europe the first in gas, so this is going to continue flowing. If Iran entered the market, and it depends when. Today, the Iranians are talking about making a deal with the International Atomic Energy Organization by June. So we're talking about several months ahead of us. The oil today has reached $118.5 a barrel. We don't know where this is going, how long the war in Ukraine is going to last, and if the sanctions are going to be lifted immediately, and the Iranian oil is going to be part of the market from day one. All these questions are still pending on this signing the deal, approving all the guarantee that Iran is asking, clearing the problem with the atomic energy that was raised by several intelligence agencies saying that Iran has other four reactors or nuclear sites that are undeclared. All that is still pending and has not been resolved yet. So I think it is still early to say this is going to have a positive or a negative or no impact on the international market.
I need to make sure that I understood you correctly, because I did a fact check here. I'm not coming up with the statement that you said there about Putin stating that if we can't sell our oil, nobody can. That is how I understood you saying that. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So let's take a look at what Hafsakar Mustafa, what Russia has said. First, the foreign minister, and some say it's a coincidence, but not, about the timing of when this came out, which says Russia wants written guarantees from U.S. that sanctions on Russia will not damage our cooperation with Iran. The piece of news said Iranian official says Russia's demand is aimed at securing its other interests. Iran, however, based on our correspondence, said those are fabricated. Iran has made no official reply yet. But the piece of news is true about Russia's, I guess, from the foreign minister, wants written guarantees. What do you think about that? What's your reaction to it?
Well, I think this is a moment where, because of the fragility on the markets, that everyone who has an upper hand in this specific sector will go into will try and exploit it to the best of their ability. I think, in a way, Lavrov has indicated that he wants to continue relations and trade with Iran, which is obviously very good. It is also a way of giving the opposing side the opportunity to say, well, you know what, this is between you and Iran, that's none of our business. And I think if that's sort of an opportunity given to the other side, it's very positive, because it obviously means that the sanctions will start to be limited exclusively to what the EU, to what European Western nations have been demanding from Iran, namely on the nuclear program, but will reduce the impact of the sanctions with other markets. So I think, all in all, it's a very understandable statement to be made by Lavrov, considering the situation and considering the situation on the gas markets today as things stand. And I don't think it's going to be a hurdle to the negotiations with Iran, precisely because at the moment I do think that the oil-producing countries do actually have the upper hand, considering the war is happening. And even if the war comes to an end within the next few days, I think the nature of the sanctions regime imposed by Western nations will not come to an end immediately. I think there's going to be a gradual step, because, of course, major measures have been taken against the Russian economy. And I don't think that any negotiation now in regards to the war will have to be made incrementally. And therefore, in the next few weeks, any decisions that can be made by Iran will benefit Iran greatly, given the fragility of the market at the moment.
Okay. You seem to be optimistic on that. Elijah Magnier, to further expand on what the Russian foreign minister has said, he said the limitations had become a stumbling block, talking about the sanctions, I guess, for the Iran nuclear deal, warning the West that Russian national interests would have to be taken into account, and that the sanctions on Russia had created a problem from Moscow's perspective. How much of a problem has it become for Moscow vis-a-vis the JCPOA revival talks?
Well, there is a very important issue Moscow is raising here. Iran said it has 33 kilos of 60% enriched uranium and 125, 27 kilos of 20%. And all that is Russia is supposed to buy it and sell it in the market. So Russia is asking for a written approval from the U.S. that this is not going to be included in the sanction, and that it will be allowed to sell on the market the additional uranium and other products that maybe Russia would like to include. So what Russia is doing, that in the midst of the highest sanction on Russia, is really twisting the Americans' hands and saying, you can't do it without us. Even when you go to talk to the Iranians, you ask us to mediate. Like today, they are asking China, that is considered a strong opponent of the U.S., to mediate with Russia. So the Russians are saying to the Americans, you don't have to continue with your double standard. And if you want our support, so let us talk about all the sanctions that you are imposing on us. And this created a problem, because it is linked to the Iranian nuclear deal, And it just a second front that is open on the JCPOA in front of the Americans, that the Americans also seems not in very much in a hurry when they say, okay, we need to confirm that these four sites are clear and they do not match the intelligence information we have. And all that is buying time to see how long Russia is going to stay in Ukraine and for how long this fight is going to last. Is it a few days, a few weeks, or several months? We don't know yet.
Well, talk about the time and it being speeded up or not, and the reactions by Iran and the other parties. Hafsakar Mostafa, I'm coming in at a different angle on the question I'm asking. And first, the German chancellor last week, while in Israel, said that this deal has to happen. It has to happen soon. It has to happen fast. Then we had today what Iranian nuclear chief Dr. Islami said, that no political influence and lobbying should impact the decisions of the IAEA. And then we had the Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett visiting Moscow, which I think that visit has already taken place or is still taking place. So I'm asking about Israel. What do you think? How much of a factor does Israel play? Oh, one other thing, Hafsakar Mostafa, I think it was 2 weeks ago, where you had a mini Israeli delegation actually visit Vienna. We're not too sure who sent invitations out to them to see what's going on there. And it was interesting to find that out when you have a regime that possesses nuclear warheads, but yet wants to find out that that Iran is getting limited or whatever they think Iran should be getting in this JCPOA revival. What do you think about the Israeli factor here?
Well, can I just say that this week, which has been incredibly rich in events, has also exposed a lot of hypocrisies. The nations that have actually invaded and violated the sovereignty of numerous nations, including Iraq, including Libya, are now lecturing Russia and Putin on its violation of Ukraine's sovereignty. So I think nothing in terms of hypocrisy is surprising. And of course, Israel's decision to actually attempt to stop any development in the nuclear sector by Iran, given that it itself possesses 200 nuclear warheads, and was admitted also by Ehud Olmert in 2002, because many people still insist that, oh, that's a sort of an open secret, but it's not. Actually, it isn't. The Prime Minister of Israel admitted that it had nuclear warheads. So whatever the Israeli position is, I think it needs to be set aside. And I think at the moment, given that it's in a very difficult position, because of course they have affinities with the Ukrainian president, who is a Jewish pro-Israel leader, and they also are in a difficult position in terms of their relationship with Russia, which is very, very close given the huge Russian community in Israel. Their position now is far weaker, and therefore I think we can set them aside and not really give them much importance, other than perhaps the influence they can have on the US Congress. But coming back to the negotiation in terms of what's going on today, I think, again, this is a very rich and eventful week. And I think whatever major decisions can be made, and major achievements on the Iranian side will have to be made within the next few days, because, of course, everything is in a flux at the moment, precisely because we don't know where the war is heading. And therefore, this is the opportunity, this is the window that will allow this sanctions regime to be reduced.
Well, you know, when you think about this in hindsight, what Iran has asked for, Elijah Magnier, is that it wants guarantees on a whole host of issues, but one of the biggest ones is the fact that it doesn't want or wanted guarantees for the U.S. not to pull out of this, something the U.S. says, I can't guarantee you that. And this conflict that has happened, the Ukrainian conflict, shows that here we have, and I'm not saying that Russia is throwing a monkey wrench here, but in a sense it is, how external factors are going to affect this JCPOA revival talks. How can there be guarantees, something that Iran has asked for, and you can use the Ukrainian conflict as one example. Is that even possible?
Well, this is a very good example in this period, a very critical period in the world, where there is a war between Russia and Ukraine. And the origin of this war is in 1990. U.S. Secretary James Baker promised Mikhail Gorbachev at that time that NATO will not expand one inch. In 1993, Warren Christopher also promised Boris Yeltsin exactly the same thing. In 1997, we have documents exchanged, all that revealed by the American National Security, and we understand written or non-written agreement or verbal agreement. The United States is not respecting its deal. There are many, many agreements in the world that in throughout the history that the Americans did not respect. So when the Iranians are saying, I need a guarantee, it's really not standing on robust ground because the United States can offer written guarantee, but that has very little value because with a new president like Donald Trump, what he did in 2018, in 2025, the same thing can be repeated with another president. So there are no guarantees. And this is what Iran is asking today. And it has to keep some buffer, like the enrichment uranium or whatever buffer Iran is asking. Now, I'm not going to discuss it. As a guarantee under the control of the International Atomic Energy in Iran that will be used against the United States and regain the production of enrichment uranium above 3.67 in case the United States doesn't respect this deal.
Okay. Well, talk about guarantees. We're looking at, I think, a contagion here, Hafsakar Mostafa, because lo and behold, we have another party to the deal. If this news is accurate, and it came from if you want to call it, a reputable organization that has come out with news that has been false. China, in which two diplomats, one of them not directly involved in the talks, said it also is demanding written guarantees that its companies doing business in Iran would not be affected by U.S. sanctions. Next thing you know, you're going to have Germany saying the same thing maybe, and then the EU coming out wanting guarantees from, I mean, this, you know, this whole thing with guarantees then is out in the open. But let's just stick with what China has said. So now you have China, now you have Russia. Both know that the U.S. has pulled out of the deal before. So how can it get guarantees from the U.S. where it can trust it?
Well, just to pick up on the point of the other panelists, I completely agree. I think that the U.S. cannot be trusted. But this is where coming back to the idea that this is a window of opportunity, and it's a very short window. But I also think, and perhaps call me overly optimistic here, but even China's remark, which does come across as sort of throwing a spanner in the wheel, is actually very positive, because this means that these countries and their intelligence services and their economists and all their analysts have actually been observing the situation and can see that the Western nations are now in a position of weakness. I think they went too far in their sanctions regime against Russia. And they realize that now, especially at this time of year, and especially in the terms of the sectors that it's impacting, it's going to be just as biting to Russia, if not to Western economies. And therefore, all these other countries are now making the most of it and actually imposing their diktat on a Western position that is far, far weaker as a result of the speed that it took in making these hasty decisions to go against Russia, precisely because, of course, it had no intention of going in militarily, given that in the last 50 years, we've only seen Western nations go up against much, much weaker countries and never, ever actually confront very powerful nuclear nations.
Very well. Thank you indeed. Thank you so much for that. Hafsakar Mostafa from London, journalist and political analyst, and Elijah Magnier, thank you for your contribution, veteran journalist and writer from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitaly. It's goodbye until next time.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
The Zionist regime's repression of human rights workers will only escalate as the investigation progresses and with no pushback from the regime's allies, who seem happy to uphold international law when it suits them. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading International Silence Fuels Israeli Regime Persecution. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime's recent designation of several prominent Palestinian groups as terrorist organizations should be easy for liberal democracies to condemn. The designations were handed out based on secret evidence and came without any due process. The organizations in question are highly respected locally and well integrated into the international human rights scene. But the EU, US, Canada, and UK have yet to explicitly reject the Zionist regime's shabby attempt. In the words of Zayd Raad al-Hussein, the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, to sully the reputations of Palestinian human rights defenders, none of these governments appear convinced by the Zionist regime's accusations, but they have not even given their ally a deadline to present credible evidence justifying the designations aimed at starving those groups of international funding. And in its attempt to isolate and marginalize these groups, some of which provide key services to Palestine's most vulnerable communities, the Zionist regime is profoundly upending the lives of the human rights and social service providers in its crossers. One of those human rights defenders is Khatam Safin, the president of the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. In February, Safin was sentenced to 16-month imprisonment by an Israeli regime military court. She was already in Israeli regime detention and had been since November 2020. Half of that time was spent in administrative detention without charge or trial. When the Zionist regime finally did level charges against Safin, they alleged that she was helping to oversee the transfer of funds from the now outlawed Palestinian groups, including the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. As is typical of its cases against Palestinians dragged through its military court system, the Zionist regime's case against Safin relied on secret evidence to which neither she nor her lawyer were privy. Like many Palestinians denied due process in the Zionist regime's military court system, Safin agreed to a plea deal that dropped the money laundering charges. She was convicted of membership in the PFLP and to being president of the now Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. The Palestinian human rights group Al-Vamir observes that the Zionist regime initially leveled a long set of inflated charges against Safin, well beyond any singular specific act she allegedly carried out. This is another time-worn Israeli regime tactic. Inflating the number of charges is a practice widely used by the Zionist regime military prosecution to extend detention and trial procedures as a punitive and coercive measure against the detainee, Al-Damir adds. In other words, the Zionist regime throws a spaghetti pot of charges at the wall and very little sticks. but deprived of anything resembling a fair trial, Palestinian detainees agreed to plead guilty to lesser offenses they did not commit to curtail their ordeal and time away from their families. The Zionist regime also pressures Palestinians to accept IDEA plea deals in order to avoid having to prove their case against them in court. When Palestinians don't accept the plea deals, the process drags on. Muhammad Al-Halabi, a charity worker living in Gaza, is a case in point. On seemingly unending trial, Al-Halabi has been detained for more than a half a decade, and his case has gone to court some 170 times. Al-Halabi has turned down numerous plea deals, refusing to admit guilt for a crime he insists he did not commit. That is the hellish ordeal that Safin 60 was facing, and it was what Jonah Reshmavi 63 was up against when she took a similar plea deal that saw her sentenced to 13 months in prison for her work with the Palestinian Health Work Committees, a group declared illegal by the Zionist regime nearly 2020. The Health Work Committees was not informed of the designation until the Zionist regime began an escalated campaign against the organization, arresting its director, Shatta Odeh, and closing its headquarters in Ramallah, the seat of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Odeh 60 has been in Israeli regime detention since occupation troops stormed her home in July last year. The charges against Odeh primarily revolve around her leadership role in the health work committees, according to Al-Damir. Odeh is also the chair of the Palestinian NGO Network, a coalition of dozens of Palestinian civil society groups. Al-Damir argues that the arrest of Odeh indicates the Zionist regime's increasing brazenness in clamping down and criminalizing Palestinian human rights defenders and civil society organizations that challenge the Zionist regime's settler colonialism and apartheid. Ultimately, the terror designations and the Zionist regime's long-standing campaign against Palestinian human rights defenders is aimed at preserving its impunity. The Zionist regime's moves against these individuals and groups is also a sign of desperation that it is losing its grip on the narrative, with a growing consensus among international human rights groups that the Zionist regime is practicing apartheid against Palestinians. Shawan Jabarin, the director of Al-Haq, one of the targeted organizations, told a panel recently convened by the Carter Center, "We remove the mask from their faces. Global human rights consensus now holds that the Zionist regime is a colonial regime. This is an oppressive regime. We crossed the red lines when we came to the issue of accountability and going after the Israeli criminals," he added. During that same event, Wessam Ahmad, also with Al-Haq, noted that the terror designations and other moves against the Palestinian groups are being issued by the same Israeli regime officials being investigated by the International Criminal Court. The movement at the level of the International Criminal Court is something that the Palestinian civil society organizations such as Al-Haq have been heavily involved in pushing forward, and despite the Zionist regime's attempts to stifle the progress towards this investigation, it has continued to move forward. Ahmad said it comes as no surprise that the Israeli regime would take such action during the process of investigation at the ICC. It's very much a reflection of the apartheid tactics to persecute those organizations and individuals that are seeking to challenge that regime. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime's repression of human rights workers will only escalate as the investigation progresses, and with no pushback from Israeli allies who seem happy to uphold international law when it suits them. We'll be right back.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.